I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. In recent decades, the American dream has been defined by home ownership. And if you were lucky, the house came with a yard, a picket fence, and a two-car garage. This investment was the nest egg to hand down to the next generation. Government policies like the mortgage deduction, the property tax deduction, made that dream possible, although redlining and discriminatory practices prevented Black Americans from enjoying the same benefits. Diana Lind writes in her new book, Brave New Home, that the single-family home is stuck in the past, with more people living alone, with smaller families, and a desire for more community, connection. Plus, many people have been priced out of the housing market. She writes about some exciting new trends, multi-generational units, co-living communities, tiny homes, and backyard cottages. She is the executive director of the Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia and a housing fellow at New Cities. She joined us by Skype. Diana Lind, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Taya Nguyen, and she has worked on affordable housing issues in Philadelphia for years now. She's a trained architect and the new executive director of the Community Design Collaborative. She's a former director of project planning and design for Habitat for Humanity Philadelphia. And Taya Nguyen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. You're welcome. We're going to get your volume just boosted up so that everyone can hear you. Diana, let me begin with you. And I mentioned the mortgage and the property tax deductions, but how did the single-family home become such a potent American dream, even beyond some of these financial and tax deductions?
Sure. So the single-family home with a white picket fence that you alluded to has been seen as the American dream and often assumed that Americans have always lived this way. But actually, when you look back at the history of the country, in the time really prior to World War I, there were a lot of different ways in which people lived. They lived in boarding houses and inns and taverns. They lived in tenements. They lived in apartment hotels. There was really sort of a greater diversity of housing choices. Really starting in the period following World War I, there were both government policies and also sort of a media push towards single-family homes, national movements, things called Own Your Own Home, the Own Your Own Home movement, and the sort of birth of the car industry, and highway infrastructure, all of these various different issues really contributed to sort of the push towards single-family homes that really started to push people outside of cities into suburbs and into their own homes with their backyards. And it's a trend that has been happening for, you know, the past 100 years. And certainly there has been a way in which there's been an alignment between, you know, government policies that have supported this and also narratives that have encouraged the single family home as being sort of superior to other styles of living.
Sure. A confluence of many factors all seem to kind of coalesce in the last 50 years or so. As you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, the Levittowns that sprung up after World War II, these planned communities. There's, you know, one right outside of Philadelphia. Is that the kind of single family home that you have in mind?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great example of it. And, you know, Levittown was definitely part of one wave of suburbanization, but also, you know, there are, you know, single family homes that were built decades before that. And certainly since then, less sort of fully developed communities and more standalone single family homes. But that's the general idea, the home with the backyard and the garage.
And the garage. I mean, it, you know, the Levittowns of today, by McMansion standards, are, you know, a rather, I should say, modest, you know, in a very sort of community kind of way. The houses are relatively close together. The backyards often, you know, share a common fence.
Yeah, absolutely. The housing styles and sizes have really changed over the years. You know, many of those homes in the 1940s and 50s, the average size was around 1,500 square feet. People would raise three children in homes that size. Nowadays, it's very common to see homes that are, you know, 4,000 square feet with a lot of additional spaces that are kind of added on. And it's a little bit like what you might see in a restaurant, kind of larger portions. It's easier to charge for a larger
bigger
meal,
plates,
if you will.
Right,
exactly. And so that's another thing that really drives up prices in places, because you can, you know, a lot of people think about housing in terms of price per square foot, and a larger home is going to command a higher price. So, of course, developers are interested in building these much larger homes.
Taya Nguyen, let me get you in on the conversation and more officially welcome you to Radio Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I mentioned this in my introduction, I mean, talking about the single family home, the kind of discrimination that African-American families often faced. And when we talk about the wealth gap, even today, the fact that Black families don't own homes the way white families do has, in certain ways, help to describe and define this wealth gap. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. So I think we've been able to see over time that the racial wealth gap can actually be ascribed to equity from housing value. And I think, you know, looking at many of the government policies that we've seen really since the onset of the, you know, 1930s, around the time that war ended, many of them actively blocked African-Americans and actually other races as well. It's been equally as difficult for the Latino community, also many immigrant communities, and at one point in time, even the Jewish community, to access these resources as well, that effectively barred them from being able to participate in the housing market in the same way as any Caucasian counterparts. Over time, as the communities increased in value, right, as cities grew, that gap continued to widen.
And here we are today. Let me go back to you, Diana Lind. And your book is really about how things are changing when it comes to housing and what it is that people want from their housing. You mentioned the fact that in some of these larger homes, these 4,000 square foot homes, there's a lot of under-occupied or underused space. If we're talking about, let's say, young people who might be getting in on the market or living on their own, what do young people want when it comes to housing?
Well, I think that there's a lot of different things that potentially young people want. But what is exciting about the moment right now is that we're a really large country. And so, you know, even if you have some portion of, say, millennials who are interested in not living in a single family home, but say living in a more intentional community like a co-living situation, that's still going to represent hundreds of thousands of young people. And so that's okay. So there's not sort of one monolithic thing. I think that, you know, that vision of housing back in the 1950s was much more monolithic, and it was much more exclusionary and focused around sort of a heteronormative family, white family of four. That's definitely not the kind of demographics that we see today. And so that 4,000 square foot home, you know, if let's just say you have a young person who's able to afford that home, they might say, I don't want to use it as a single family home. I want to carve out a accessory dwelling unit within it for an Airbnb, or maybe to house my older parent or something like that. They're much more inclined to think beyond just, you know, a large home for raising a family in the future.
Taya Nguyen, let me go back to you. And I'm thinking of Philadelphia, a city you have worked in for some time now, and just our, you know, our famous row houses. I mean, in certain ways, the row house had a kind of built-in community. These are not generally large homes. People often, you know, knew each other, took care of each other's children. Are we sort of not reinventing, but sort of going back and re-embracing this idea of the row home?
I do. I mean, I think when you look at Philadelphia, one, our most common building typology is the row home. It is the essential fabric of what makes up Philadelphia. When we're looking at what's vacant and what's contextual for properties that are going back into some of our, you know, deeply, deeply entrenched neighborhoods, what is it's scattered site infill in between row homes. So I do think that as we look, one thing that we know, right, and it's been studied even in Philadelphia, like the city put out the Philadelphia Row House Manual many years ago, the row house is the most efficient single family home you can get, right? And so I think it is not necessarily as much of a resurgence as it's a practicality. Right. If you're looking for a house in Philadelphia, what would you look for? I think to go back to the question you asked Diana about what you know, millennials or young people are looking for. I'm a millennial, very barely, but I am. And they're looking for homes they can afford, right? We've got ballooning educational debt. The job market for much of the time that we have been young adults and in part of the working demographic has not necessarily been stable. Many of us graduated in the height of the last recession. And, you know, I think we've kind of weathered through, but there haven't been like the best economic times in many of these sectors, even up to now. I don't think most millennials can afford homes. And so when you're looking at the market in Philadelphia, there's really not that much you're going to get, especially if you're looking at a new construction or a rehab, that's going to be more affordable than your like standard working man's row home.
Well, Diane Lynn, I mean, certainly is what old is perhaps new.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. What Ty was just saying reminds me of a conversation I had with someone who works in housing in Philadelphia, talking about tiny homes and all of the interest around tiny homes these days, and saying, you know, the original tiny home is some of those Philadelphia row houses, you know, like those South Philly row houses that are 700, 800 square feet. Those are kind of a little bit like a tiny home. It's a little bit bigger than, you know, the so-called tiny homes of today. But, you know, those are homes that are small, and they work well for kind of your entry level homeowner or renter in neighborhoods. And so I think that that's one of the great things about Philadelphia's housing stock, is that we do have that range, and we do have, you know, homes that can be more accessible to people's price points.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversations. That's Diana Lind. She's the executive director of the Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia. She's also a housing fellow at New Cities. And she's got a new book, Brave New Home, Our Future in Smarter, Simpler, Happier Housing. Taya Nguyen is with us as well, joining us by Skype. And she's a architect, the executive director of the Community Design Collaborative. And we're talking about rethinking the single family home, or reimagining the single family home. And as always, we want to hear from you. Send us an email. radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Full disclosure, I live in a single family home. I've lived here for 40 years with a very tight-knit community. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And just a recap here, one of the hallmarks of the American dream, an enduring hallmark, is a single-family home with a yard, a picket fence, a two-car garage. I'm talking with Diana Lind and Taya Nguyen about how to right-size and downsize and reinvent that dream. Lind's new book is Brave New Home, and Nguyen is the executive director of the Community Design Collaborative. Let me go back to you, if I could, Taya Nguyen. And I'm just thinking about, you know, I almost begin every conversation these days about how the pandemic has changed everything. But I'm thinking of the recession, the Great Recession of more than a decade ago, and now today's pandemic. Do you think those two forces are getting us all to think differently about how we live and the kind of structure that we want to live in?
I would like to think so. I do think that for the folks that didn't do it willingly, I think the effects of the last year have definitely forced them to think long and hard about, one, what's most important. I think both prioritizing our lives, right? I think in our country, specifically, you know, as Americans, we work a lot, we spend a lot of money. We are a true capitalistic society. And I think times like this kind of force you to step back and really zero in on what matters most. Having done some travel in the last few years, looking at social and public housing in other countries and having to kind of understand cultures around poverty outside of the United States context, a lot of other cultures have already embraced some of these aspects that I think we're just now starting to look into.
Such as?
I think this, I think housing, right? I think the American dream of this like single family home, the white picket fence, Diana kind of covered all of it at the top of the call, is really, I think it's a figment of our imagination. I think historically, that's not how most people live. That's not how most people who live in cities live. And that's not how the majority of the world's population lives when you leave the United States. And I think in other countries, they figured out ways to both share resources, right? I think you see more intergenerational living when you go overseas. You see much more compact apartments and a lot more efficient thought given to, say, appliances or furniture. I think, you know, from a travel aspect, I'm sure everybody that's traveled overseas can imagine what it was like going into like a European apartment and seeing a refrigerator that was shorter than them.
I was just thinking of that. It's funny you said that. Yes. It's tiny by our standards.
It's very tiny. Very tiny by our standards. Or like a washer dryer that's in the bathroom that also doubles as two other things and it's one unit, you know, just things that we are atypical in our country.
Well, let me go back to you, Diana Lynn, and you were talking about, and you're right about the impact of the focus on the single family home, and of course then you have malls that grow up nearby. You've got then roads to get to the malls. Then you've got traffic jam. Then you've got commuting. That there have been perhaps some unintended side effects about this focus on the single family home. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean there are a ton of them. I think that, you know, one of the hopes for the book was really to look at why is, you know, a lot of societal problems that we have socially, economically, environmentally, and how they're caused by housing. And so, you know, to your point about how single family homes really kind of describe a certain type of urban development, you end up having, you know, neighborhoods that don't have retail that is walkable nearby, and therefore people do have to drive, which then affects sort of the climate change and carbon output of the environmental consequences of that car-driven lifestyle. You find that these homes, by virtue of the fact that they're sort of one type of home, and people in those neighborhoods tend to end up becoming very focused on how their property values fluctuate and very concerned about any type of home that could potentially lower those property values. If it's, you know, they probably don't want a tiny home nearby. They probably don't want multifamily housing nearby or anything that looks any different from that. And that continues to raise property values. And then there are the sort of social consequences of each home being, you know, an acre apart from another home, and how you have lessened social interaction. You might not have as many so-called weak ties to people in your neighborhood, a sense of community that comes just by virtue of the fact that you all have, you know, shared infrastructure. And so that type of, you know, residential living in the U.S. comes with a lot of consequences. And I think, you know, too often we have kind of glazed over some of these negative externalities just by, you know, always praising some of the benefits, say, of privacy and of, you know, home ownership, property values rising.
I mean, I, you know, just speaking personally here, I'm someone who values privacy. Is there a way to, you know, have a single family home and also to feel connected to your neighbors and to your community? So there's certainly lots of towns, I would think, Diana, that fit that kind of definition. So they're not this sprawling, you know, mansions with acres between houses, but the houses are actually pretty close together and people do actually know each other, but they live separately.
Right. Yes. And I should say that this is not the only way that people can live or the only way that this type of development exists. I definitely think that there are ways for people to live and that's, you know, more communal. Some of the examples I give in the book are examples of communities that have focused on intentional communities. So whether that might be, you know, a wellness community in Georgia called Serenby, which is really trying to rethink what the suburban lifestyle is like. And it has a mix of single family homes and multifamily homes, homes that have backyard cottages, homes of varying different sizes. And I think that can provide community and connection in a way in which it allows for kind of more diverse household types and it's, you know, an example of a community that's really built around walking from neighborhood to neighborhood. So you do see more people on the street and perhaps connect that way. You know, there are certainly examples of things like co-housing, which are another type of more intentional community where there are some sort of shared infrastructure aspects, whether that's, you know, a communal dining room or even just a field for everyone to share rather than it being everyone's backyard. Something that I've certainly realized in the process of both talking about the book and writing on the book is that people have different experiences with what these types of communities are like. For some people, they live in a neighborhood where the houses are not very far apart. Mm-hmm. And certainly the row houses, those are single family homes. They're not far apart either. And, you know, they do find a great sense of community. But for some other people, not having opportunities to walk, to see your neighbors, to have shared resources. These are issues for them that really prevent them from feeling a sense of connection.
Ty Nguyen, can you talk about something called middle housing? I'd never heard of it until I was doing preparation for today's show. But what is that and how does that address what we've been talking about?
Absolutely. So the concept of the missing middle kind of looks at the housing market as a spectrum. So if, you know, in the examples we've used today, the 4,000 square foot McMansion is at one end of the spectrum, you know, what's that opposite end of the spectrum? We've kind of outlined many different types of housing, at least Diana has, and looking at, you know, there are many different types of people. People are diverse. And I think historically, we've always had a variety of housing types, right? Most of the concepts that we have mentioned today aren't new, right? Co-housing, it already existed. It was the boarding house, right? Everybody knows the YMCA song. You know, if I, as a single, unmarried woman, even at, you know, in my mid-30s, had been living in this city at the turn of the century, I would have lived in a boarding house, right? I would have had a room. It would have been almost like living in a hotel. I maybe would have had to share a bathroom if I was lucky. They were essentially glorified dormitories, and we went away from them. And so the co-housing isn't a new concept. I think we've rebranded it to make it palatable in today's market. Micro units, right? Micro units existed. They were the efficiencies. They were the studios. They were the SROs of times past. We've had all of these housing types in the past. We just moved away from them. And we've stigmatized them at the same time. Like, you know, we see them as less than. Whereas one thing that we're starting to realize is there are many people that would prefer to live in some of these aspects. There are people that know that, you know, I'm going to be single, right? We've got people that need more supportive services, right? Those that maybe they're living independently, but they would benefit from the social setting or kind of shared amenities where they can have that community, or they can have kind of on-site support for whatever they need. And I think in kind of assuming that everybody wants the single family home, people spend a lot of time adapting single family homes when that's not the typology that's best suited for their life.
And that's Taya Nguyen. She's an architect, also the executive director of the Community Design Collaborative that's in Philadelphia. Diana Lind is executive director of the Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia. She's a housing fellow at New Cities, and she's got a new book called Brave New Home. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dan, as I was preparing the show today, I was remembering interviews I did with Maggie Kuhn. She was the founder of the Gray Panthers, actually lived in Philadelphia. And she lived in a intergenerational, multi-generational home. I believe it was her own home. And she had a number of people that lived with her in support with their own rooms. But there was this sense of congregation and community. So it's interesting that As Taya was describing, some of these old ideas seem to be sort of gaining in popularity these days. Is it just we're sort of at this demographic shift, do you think?
Yeah, I do. And I think that there are a lot of, you know, social and economic pressures on people right now that are changing what type of housing they want to live in. So multi-generational housing is a really great example of that. And as Taya was mentioning, sort of what's old is new again, many of the housing types that people are sort of rediscovering right now certainly existed in the past. And as she also mentioned, you know, multi-generational housing is something that is way more common outside of the U.S. But, you know, historically, families had had lived in the U.S. multi-generationally, and the percentage of people living multi-generationally continued to decline until about the 1980s when it started to turn back up. And what we're seeing now is actually we're at the highest level multi-generational households since the 1950s, and that was a stat, you know, pre-pandemic in 2018. Wow. I have to imagine it's only going to become a even higher percentage as so many families have moved in together during this time to, you know, have a larger pod of people that they're connecting with, to have help with, you know, looking after kids who are doing remote schooling, to just, you know, get help to deal with COVID and other related illnesses. So that is definitely something that I think we're going to see a lot more of, and is something that, you know, the U.S. used to embrace. And I think that, you know, there are lots of different benefits of multi-generational housing, whether it is that kind of access to additional adults in the household who can provide, you know, whether it's financial resources or social resources to the families. It's, you know, it's certainly a more sustainable way of living rather than everyone having their own separate home. And I think it's, you know, there have been proven to be health benefits in terms of, you know, being able to take care of older people as their, you know, physical condition declines. Can be really helpful to have that younger generation. Likewise, for kids to have grandparents can be really helpful to those kids and their education. So I think that's definitely a trend that we're going to see a lot more of.
We've got a number of emails here. One from Dave. Do your guests think that the pandemic may cause people to second guess their desire to live in dense, efficient homes and maybe even look for more space in the suburbs, which is kind of a reverse of what we're talking about? But Taya, any thoughts about that?
I actually don't think that's true. The CDC put out some numbers the other day tracking coronavirus cases by type of kind of township city, and what they were finding is there actually a higher rate of coronavirus in the suburbs, where we already know that there is more spacing. I think people have a fear of density, right? But I think it's a perceived fear.
Here's an email from Robert. I'll give this to you, Diana. She says, if we want to see more accessory dwelling units, co-hosting or innovative identification in the Philadelphia area suburban community, where can we find it? What towns, if any, are open to it? And your book is about a number of communities across the country. Anything in the Philly area that people can at least think about or take a look at?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it is really like a township by township situation in terms of, you know, how you can build accessory dwelling units. What you want to look for are the kinds of regulations that are going to be as kind of open to what you want to build. In a lot of cases, people can't build accessory dwelling units because there are, you know, conditions on that accessory dwelling unit having a separate parking space or being a certain distance from a lot line, you know, some sort of ratio to of size compared to the main house and so on. So the townships that are kind of most open to accessory dwelling units will make it the easiest process to that. Unfortunately, I don't know which ones in the area are the best for that, but, you know, we can look to examples like in California and Oregon where statewide they had accessory dwelling unit reform to make it easier for people to build on their properties.
Here's a question from Mark related to this. I'll put this to you, Ty. He says, can your guests address the need to change zoning laws in order to permit more diverse housing options, which is really what Diana was referring to. But can you expand on that?
Absolutely. So I think when you're looking at zoning, right, the zoning overlay really tells what can and cannot be built in a city. And right now in Philadelphia, our smallest zoning type, right, is our single family lot, which in Philadelphia, for those of you that don't know, is RSA 5, which stipulates that the lot has to be 1,440 square feet. And in that 1440, right, it has to have a 15-foot width, which puts you at a 90-foot depth. I'm sure many of you that are listening in your cars or at home through your computer as you work from home know and can look at your own lot and know, like, sure, my lot isn't that big, right? So I think that's the, kind of the first thing, having worked in affordable housing, oftentimes trying to right size units or find a unit without having too much backyard, but having enough of the unit, it's difficult, but it makes it very difficult for some of these smaller, more compact and efficient typologies that Diana has mentioned, specifically thinking of things like tiny houses, right? Tiny houses do not need 15 feet wide. They are 200 to 600 square feet. A typical Philadelphia row house is 1,200. It's half the square footage. And I think, you know, in trying to figure out how to make options like that work, we're going to have to get a little more creative. I think also, you know
what, Taya, hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break and we'll be right back talking with Taya Nguyen and Diana Lind about how to rethink housing.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we are rethinking the single-family home, talking about growing interest in things like tiny houses, sustainable, affordable housing, co-living, communal living arrangements, multi-generational homes, and other creative housing alternatives. Our guests are Diana Lind. She's got a brave new book. It's called Brave New Home. She's also the executive director of the Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia. And Taya Nguyen is also with us. She's the new executive director of Philadelphia's Community Design Collaborative. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Taya, I had to interrupt you. You were talking about being creative.
Absolutely. You know, I think going back to this question of ADUs, that's another big one. There are cities where ADUs have really taken off. They're popular in Arizona, many parts of California. I know Northern California, like Fresno, they've been looking at them in San Francisco and in Oakland in the Bay Area, and they're popular in Denver. So, like, there's cities where they're popular. And there's cities where they're more suited. I think ADUs tend to do better in places that have alleys, right? Hmm. So knowing in our context that like middle alley is really what makes them difficult here, because how do you access it when you have front, you know, line to line or wall to wall street frontage with a Philadelphia row home? But they are possible in some neighborhoods. We do have neighborhoods that can accommodate ADUs. And, you know, at the beginning of 2020, in the midst of all that, right before all everything got crazy, we did pass legislation in Philadelphia that opened up and made it easier for ADUs to occur in specific neighborhoods. So I believe right now they're possible in many parts of the Northeast. There are definitely lots in the city that are easier to facilitate, some that we see in North Philadelphia where we have detached homes. And there was an overlay that was changed for historic properties that also allowed them to convert, you know, coach houses, garages and things of that nature into ADUs. So right. It's not impossible in Philly.
And just so people know, ADU is accessory dwelling units, just to make sure that everyone understands what that's referring to. Let me ask you, Diana, about something you write about. These are communities built around grand families, and these are grandparents who are raising their grandchildren. You describe one in South Tucson, Las Abuelitas. Can you describe how that works? And it sounds wonderful, I have to say.
Sure. Yeah. So this was a project that was built by a nonprofit developer in coordination with a local group that was focused on, you know, grand families essentially and grandparents helping grandchildren without this middle generation of parents. And so this project that was built was a series of essentially townhomes, you know, individual townhomes, all oriented around shared spaces, including essentially a small rec center, which had, you know, a computer lab, a space for a classroom or a playroom, and a shared kitchen, as well as kind of community gardens, a little bit of a dog run space and just kind of wooded nature space, as well as kind of more just play spaces outdoors. And the idea being that this project was also very sensitive to the needs of grandparents and the ways that they would be raising young children, thinking that, you know, in some cases they would really prefer to have a space that would be enclosed and easy for them to look after their kids without having to like run after them or worry that they're going to go into the street. That they wanted to have some degree of privacy. So, for example, even though it would be just a two-bedroom house, a small two-bedroom house, there would be two bathrooms so that the grandparents could have their own bathroom, because that was something that was really important to them in raising their kids. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of these kinds of, you know, smart elements, like each townhouse has its own small patio that they could have as their own private space with essentially shutters that could open and close to the more communal spaces. And I think, you know, it's a project that actually, because of the ways in which you're not allowed to use sort of federal money to, you know, market only to one set of people, you know, and therefore discriminate against who could live in this type of housing. It's not only been used by grand families at this point, it's other types of sort of low income families are also living there. But I think that it's a great example of how you can use smart design to tailor housing for new demographics that really need housing that, you know, responds to their needs.
Well, let me pick up on that and Tai Nguyen, go to you. We've been focusing on housing and houses, but obviously there's the community at large. It's you know, where the house sits, who, what is next to the house. How do we design communities that support the kind of connection and cooperation that we've been talking about?
Absolutely. And I think it starts with community input and engagement. I think the people that know the most about what they need in their community are those residents living in it.
Oops. Did we lose you?
Nope. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Okay. You're back. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Sorry. That's okay. So what I said was, I think absolutely. I think the biggest key right now is community engagement. I think asking the residents of a neighborhood what they need, they're the best experts of what it is that they need in their neighborhoods. And so I think we need to kind of embrace the idea of bringing them along in the process from the beginning so that they have a chance and they have the agency to be active participants in building their own communities.
Jane, let me read an email from Elizabeth. It's a little bit long, but it's worth hearing. She says, I was amused listening to your commentary about Levittown. Now I'm in my 60s. I'm living in my childhood home in Levittown, Pennsylvania, and almost anyone who grew up around here has fond memories. Until recently, I had the same next-door neighbor for over 50 years. I grew up with their children and know all of their grandchildren. My neighbor, who lives on the other side of the street, has known me since I was 4 years old. She's in her 90s now, like a second mom to me. My parents bought this house in the late 1950s because it was so affordable. I think my dad put around $250 to purchase it. I mean, that's community, is it not?
Yes, totally. And, you know, and this is, I think I have to find a better way of framing the conversation around single family homes and suburbia so as to not say that it is, it's causation, right? It's not causation. It's not necessarily that, you know, you move into a suburb, you're automatically going to not have a community or something like that. It's just not the case. It's a little bit more of correlation. And I think it's also really about the whole idea of the book is not to say like you can't live that way, although there are some people who would argue actually yes, it's exclusionary, it's bad for the environment, and it's this type of housing really prevents other types of multifamily or other kinds of housing that would lower property costs and housing costs. So there are some people who would take that stance. I wouldn't necessarily take that stance, but I would say to the Taya's point about being able to respond to what people really want, that we haven't done a great job of actually engaging people with and understanding what our communities really want and need. And so there are people who, still want that same housing type from the 1950s. There are a lot of people who would actually be interested in something that is maybe a little bit of a combination of that. So Ty was talking about accessory dwelling units, and I was thinking about how could we make it easier to build row homes that automatically have an accessory dwelling unit built into it as a first floor apartment? How difficult would that be to make that happen? Because that would automatically provide one more housing unit for each single family home that we're building in the city. And that might be something that a lot of people are really interested in, but it's not something that developers are going to go towards because it's not something that they've seen be profitable and easy and, fit with the zoning and all that kind of stuff. So I think that there does need to be a larger sort of civic dialogue for the people who feel, great, have your single family homes, but other people really want something different. And that might be, a way for us to also ensure that their housing needs are being met and see how, whether that also results in, community, more affordability and more sustainability.
I'm thinking of multiplexes, triplexes, duplexes, as you are describing that, Diana. They do exist, but you're saying we need more of that.
I think so.
And
yeah,
others.
In general. And it's very,
and others,
it's hard to build it.
Because of zoning and cost and all that. Yeah, Taya, did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I think they also don't fit in every neighborhood context, right? We have neighborhoods where there's blocks and blocks and blocks of two-story row homes. Sure, you can fit a duplex in there, but even if you want a larger duplex, you'd have to do a basement floor for the duplex. There are many council districts where that's just not ideal. There's many streets where there's not enough sidewalk width to get a proper legal egress. So I think that's always going to continue to be an issue. I think we've got to find solutions that are flexible, and we have a variety of options to fit our variety of street widths, our variety of sidewalk widths, and neighborhood types. I'm tired of seeing four-story, triplexes go up in neighborhoods that were all two-story buildings.
Yeah. Let me read a tweet from Karenina, and actually, Taya, I'm going to send this back to you. She says, the majority of immigrants in South Philadelphia live in multifamily homes. I was representing a Mexican family when a lawyer for Philadelphia's Department of Human Services referred to it with obvious disdain as, quote, some kind of boarding house. And I think you both have referred to the kind of stereotyping of, you know, the things that are that don't meet the definition of a single family home. Can you respond to that, Taya?
Yeah, I think it has to do with fear. I think, you know, there have been many comments that were made this year in the media by folks that may or may not have been in charge of the country that led people down a lane of believing that affordable housing has a negative impact on their property value. And I think in Philadelphia, people hear the term boarding house and they immediately think of fires. They think of, like, you know, illegal, like there's an illegality that's kind of baked into when that word is used. It's really a euphemism for too many poor people living next to me. And I think that a lot of the perception is just not true, right? The New York Furman Center did a study a few years ago. They called it Don't Put It Here. It was really based on this kind of idea of NIMBYism that we see in a lot of these conversations. And in that report, they completely debunked the idea that affordable housing lowers surrounding property values. And I think a lot of it has to do around education, right? I think Diana was right. We need to educate people. We need to engage people, all people, not just citizens. It also needs to happen, I think, at a lot of our civic levels as well. Half of the drama of getting these projects done happens through trying to track it through regulatory processes, right? It's not easy to get these through LNI. When LNI is working with you, we don't have the policies and procedures in place that set it up for success. I think of two recent developments, just kind of in the vein of what we've been talking about in the second half of the hour. There are two developers in Philly that I know have been trying to get grandparent apartments where they're raising their grandchildren approved for years. And one of them is finally moving. Community Ventures is a nonprofit agency. And they've just put, they're almost done with construction of their project up in North Philly near Temple, right? But they've probably been working on it for 7 years. And wow. Funding it was difficult. Getting approvals on it was difficult. There's another developer in West Philadelphia, Ojima. He's been trying to work on a very similar idea. And, like, people won't finance them. They can't get the community buy-in they need to even get through preliminary zoning approvals. And I think a lot of that has to do with anything new and unfamiliar evokes a fear of what people don't know.
So you're talking red tape, bureaucracy, zoning, and how that all comes together. We're almost out of time. And let me put a more sort of global question to you, Diana Lynn, because I think for a lot of people wanting to buy a home, they're really priced out of the market. And I think even since the pandemic, you're seeing prices just going sky high in certain parts of the country. How do we make housing more affordable to more people?
That is the really big question for so many people to try to figure out. And I think one of the ideas, you know, two key ideas that I put forward in the book. One is that we need more housing options that fit people's price ranges. You know, smaller homes, some people can only afford 200 square feet. It shouldn't be illegal to have an apartment or a tiny home that size if that's what you can afford. And so I think a lot of people have been priced out by size, by the size of lots and so on. So we need to have more housing options that work for people's budgets. And, you know, housing options that allow people to, you know, have a flexible lease that doesn't require, you know, putting a year's salary, you know, ensuring that you have a year's worth of salary of being able to pay your rent. And some of that may have changed during COVID, but flexible housing, more housing options, I think is one answer to that. I think the second answer to it is that we have a lot of policies that have really kind of propped up the price of housing. Things like the mortgage interest deduction being a really great example of essentially a tax loophole that goes towards the wealthiest people who can afford the most housing and the highest mortgage. And so having rethinking our housing policies that are essentially propping up home ownership and really ensuring that home ownership is the only way that many families can create wealth. So we really need to rethink wealth creation in this country so that people aren't only buying homes to see their property values rise, which in turn displaces people, causes gentrification, and all these other things that they don't really want to see happen. So housing policies that are oriented towards renters and non-homeowners and really geared towards wealth creation for them, I think that would be great.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Diana Lynn, Executive Director of the Arts and Business Council for Greater Philadelphia, author of Brave New Home, Our Future in Smarter, Simpler, Happier Housing. Diana Lynn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Taya Nguyen is Executive Director of Community Design Collaborative in Philadelphia. Taya Nguyen, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, and I enjoyed speaking with both of you today.
Thanks so much. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.